Here, I'll take that. I guess if we just start at the beginning, then there are a few things I'd like to know. I'd like to know, firstly, if you were born in Winnipeg or in Manitoba.
Yeah, I was born in Winnipeg.
And did you go to...
I was always just in Winnipeg here until I joined up in 1939. I worked prior to that with the CPR Telegraphs. I was a messenger boy.
Yeah, you went to school in Winnipeg?
Yeah, I went to school up until I finished grade 9, passed at 10, but then I had to go to work because we didn't have anybody. Just my one brother was working at the time. So I went out as a delivery boy in grocery stores. And then I got the job with the CPR Telegraphs from 36 to 39. And I volunteered for the Grenadiers.
From 36 to 39?
Yeah, September the 13th, 1936. And I got out on March the 22nd, 1946. Or 1939 is when I joined up.
Right.
Like September the 13th, 1939. I said 36 before.
Yeah. Possibly. I was wondering why you joined up. Had the war started, or did you have friends going in at the time?
No, the war had been declared, I think, September the 10th. And I thought, well, I might as well volunteer to what I wanted to go into, which was Cooper's machine gun. I wanted to become a machine gunner.
Right.
And both my brothers by this time were in the Air Force.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
But I joined up the Winnipeg Grenadiers because they were a machine gunner. But which had happened later, they didn't get. They were changed into an infantry outfit, which I wasn't very happy about.
Well, did you do any training in Winnipeg?
Oh yeah, we had 9 solid months of training on the Gutfish machine gun. We had to learn how to take it apart and put it together blindfold.
What rank would you be at the time?
I was just a private at the time.
What company?
At the D Company.
D Company. Yeah. And was the training done here in Winnipeg?
Mm-hmm. We used to do it right at first. We first did some of our training at Minto Armories.
Oh, yeah.
We were there until I guess it was in December of 1939. We used to just go there in the morning and then go home in the afternoon about 4 o'clock until we got into barracks at Fort Osmond Barracks. And then that's when our heavy training started in Fort Osmond Barracks on the Vickers machine gun.
Did you have any friends, like outside friends, who went in with you, or did you?
No, the only person I knew in the Grenadiers up to that time was Captain Bob Phillips. He used to be in an office in the Winnipeg Electric Chambers, but he belonged to the Winnipeg Grenadiers. And I guess him talking to me at first, because he was called up right away, of course. He was with the reserve. And I saw him down the very first day I went down to join the Winnipeg Grenadiers and into armies.
After your training was concluded here in Winnipeg, then what happened?
Then we were shipped to Jamaica. It was just shortly after we were shipped to Jamaica that we became an infantry outfit. They picked off the MG machine gunners. And we didn't have any, we practiced a little bit on bayonet fighting and stuff like that there, plus a bit of Lewis gun and Bren gun training there. But most of the time we were on internment guard with these Italians and German internees. We were on 24 hours and off 24 hours.
On 24 hours and off, that meant you would be at the barracks and on call for 24 hours? Or?
Yeah, we were supposed to be on what they called riots. We did get the odd passes, but not very often, because we were supposed to be on call. We were sort of understaffed. And we were on call for riot squad detail there, because the detention, one of the Jamaicans there in the internment camp, and there was quite a smell about it, because the Jamaicans didn't want him interned and so forth. And we were called out on riot squads a few times because the Jamaicans would start getting around the internment camp too many, and so they would call an extra bunch from the camp to go out and help the internment guard, which was only maybe a mile or so away from camp anyways.
Did you undergo any training when you were in Jamaica? Any further training?
Yeah, as you say, we were training with bayonet fighting and Lewis guns and Bren guns, because this is with the outfit, the infantry outfit trained on. But we never saw another Vickers gun after that.
Well, when the Grenadiers were recalled to Winnipeg, did you have any idea at that time where you would be going?
Well, the only thing that we were told when we, OMMHK, which is, you'll see in that book, he was our commanding officer at the time. He used to be a lawyer here, I think, at the prosecuting, what do they call him? The prosecutor of OMMHK. And he became a brigadier after he'd been with us, and he came back to Canada. And shortly after that, he promised us that when we came back, he'd be going over to the old country.
Meaning England?
In England, and the European war against the Germans and that. And when we came through, I was on the advance guard, as they called them, to come to Winnipeg first. It was D Company and a few others, but it was mostly D Company that came as an advance guard to Winnipeg. And as we came through Montreal, coming up to Montreal, Brigadier K got on the train and told us that within the next 3 months we'd be going overseas to the European. So we didn't have no idea of going to Hong Kong. And then after we'd been here for, I think it was 6 weeks I was here, some of the boys weren't here that long because the rest of the Grenadiers came, and some of them only had a couple of weeks, and we were all recalled and got issued tropical clothing. So maybe we thought possibly we'd be heading for India or Africa. Because they said we were going to be going overseas, we figured we were going to be maybe going into combat in hot countries. We never thought of Hong Kong at all.
Well, do you remember if many of the guys were sorry to leave Jamaica? Or were you sort of looking for some kind of...
Well, I wasn't. I think the biggest majority of our boys were ready to go fighting because we were just fed up with internment guard business, and we joined up to help our country and so forth, and that, and here we were just stuck as internment guards, and we figured we were a pretty good outfit. Mind you, I will say that I think myself that we slightly deteriorated while we were in Jamaica, because I think a lot of boys were very disgusted when we turned into an infantry outfit, because I would say that 95%, well, I would say 100% of our boys that went over to Jamaica were volunteers, and the officers and some of the other men were with the reserve at the time of the army, and of course they were with the Grenadiers at that time. So I think they all wanted to become machine gunners, mm-hmm. otherwise I don't think they would have joined the outfit. Right. And then I think they were very disappointed when we were turned into an infantry outfit. And I think a lot of them lost a lot of interest. They went. And after being down there for 16 months in that heat and everything else, and internment guard every 24 hours, you were just on a day and you were off a day and you were back on again. Bases, you know. And it's, you know, you got this very disgusted and very discouraged,
right.
In my opinion, anyways. I know I was.
Do you remember how notice came that you were going to be infantry? Did they just take the machine guns away?
Didn't have no machine guns when we went down there. And all of a sudden they, instead of, because we were only supposed to be there a short time or something on this principle, and then all of a sudden we were classed as Winnipeg Grenadiers, the infantry regiment. And as I say, I think from then on a lot of the boys just didn't, you know, they just felt a lot lower. We figured that the prestige had been taken away from, because we, for 9 solid months we were here, all we did was machine gun and $4 in barracks. And that was like day and night we practically had it. We went out night maneuvers and everything else with machine guns, you know.
Well, when you came back for the 6 weeks, your 6 weeks, did you do any training at all?
No. I was a corporal by this time, and it was Peterson and myself. We were the NCOs at the Robinson building on, it used to be on Albert Street there. And we were barracked there. But there was only a skeleton staff there, and all the rest were given leave. And we stayed there, I think it was for 2 weeks, then we got our leave. And then we came back again, and was after another couple of weeks we were issued clothing and so forth and booked to go. And I tried in between to try to get with my brothers, because an older brother can claim you if he's in another service. So I tried to get him with the Air Force. And I'm sorry, I still haven't got the letter my brother sent me saying that you stay with the Grenadiers, the Air Force isn't that hot. And he was very sorry afterwards of that same year that he could have claimed me, but he didn't do.
Were you glad to get back to Winnipeg or to stay in Germany?
Oh, yeah, I was, because I never was fussy about the heat myself. I used to go black there all the time, but I mean, it would wear off as fast as you went out and sweated it off in the German guard anyways. But I was happy to get back to Winnipeg. I was never fussy about the hot climate. And then we were here for, as I say, for about 6 weeks, and then we went on the trains to...
We just notified all at once?
That we were moving, yeah. And there were some of the boys that didn't get back. I mean, some of them were up north, and some of them didn't get back in time. They tried to get everybody back. And then there was a few that transferred to the Air Force. Mm-hmm. Wilcox and a couple of others I know transferred to the Air Force. And then we were just on the trains again, heading up. And we picked up different recruits at different places. We picked up a bunch of recruits here to put ourselves back in full strength. And then we picked up some in Saskatoon. I wasn't sure whether we picked up any in Alberta, but I know we picked them up in different spots along going up to the coast.
Do you remember much about the recruits when they had been trained at all?
No. Some of the ones that I talked to, like we had a couple in our own company. One of them was, his name was Pfeiffer, and his father was barber in the McIntyre building. And I found out from his dad afterwards when I came back that he wasn't even of age, and his father tried to stop him in Vancouver. But the boat sailed before he got word that he was only 17. And I felt very sorry when I did see him meet his dad. I met his dad after I came back from overseas, and his dad asked me if I knew him, and I said yes. But he was with our company, but he was too young, and he just couldn't take it.
This is still D Company?
This is still D Company, yeah. I never went out of D Company. And the Pfeiffer was in our company, but he was just too young. And mind you, not that I was that old. I was 21 at this time. I joined when I was 19. And I was in prison camp on my 21st birthday. I had my birthday in April, and I was captured in December of 41, of 21.
Do you remember anything about the train trip going out to Vancouver?
We went through different places. These different ladies' auxiliaries and the Red Cross were there, you know, to hand you chocolate bars and cigarettes and stuff like that through the windows and stuff like that, because we didn't actually really stop any place for any length of time. Mm-hmm. The first incident that I can say that I was inexperienced with, and as an NCO, I lost my stripes and everything else because I helped instigate a riot on the ship that we weren't going to stay on the ship and have the officers have half the ship, and we were going to be sleeping in the hold with hammocks over the top of our mess tables.
The ship was overcrowded?
Well, the officers, it wasn't too many. It was just that the officers had too much of the ship.
Oh,
and we had our mess tables right underneath our hammocks that we were sleeping in, and a lot of us got together, and we said, well, let's get spread around the ship. We're all going to leave it 2 hours from now. I forget the exact time. It was daylight. It was after lunch. And we said that once we get out to sea, a lot of these people are going to be seasick. Yeah. And they're going to be messing all over our mess tables, and we're going to have to get up in the morning and eat our breakfast there. And we just didn't think this was right. So we had about, I would say, about 300 all ready to go off. And I was one of the leaders that went off first, and I think we had 35 men come off instead of the 300.
Where was this?
Just right in Vancouver. in Vancouver Harbor. We just walked off the ship and we weren't going to go back on unless there was something done about it. But it was Captain Bardell that came down the gangplank afterwards. He said, "What's the use, fellas? There's only 25 of you." He says, "I understand your predicament, but there's not enough of you. Anyways, come back on, otherwise you'd all class as deserters." So we all went back on ship, and we were, of course, put up in front of an officer the next day, and our company commanders and so forth. I lost my stripes then, and I got them back later on. But that was the first incident. But the trip going over wasn't that, wasn't that exciting, you know. I mean, we got down a little bit farther south, it got pretty warm, so we didn't have to sleep downstairs, we were sleeping up on the deck. And
did things change because you'd walk off the ship? Did the officers give up a little
bit? No, they didn't. Nothing happened about it, though. No. We didn't. We just had a sleepover top of our mess bunks. We were on an Australian luxury liner, as they classed them at those days. It just made into a troop ship, and it had, I imagine you've heard this before, but they had nothing going but mutton to us, for us. We used to have them trike for breakfast and stuff on this one, so lamb chops and in the afternoon, and lamb stew at night or something on this one, but all we had was mutton. I imagine you've read that Oriental Odyssey, you've got nothing but mutton on, and that's exactly the way it was over there, going over there. We had a few zigzag courses. I understand we hit almost to the top of Australia.
We're on the boat.
And you see, there wasn't that much, not too many incidents that were. Now, I'll tell you a funny incident that happened to me personally. I mean, you may not keep it on the tape.
Sure, that's what I'm after. All kinds of personal.
But at different times, different NCOs had to take charge of the ship, and I only did it the once going over the whole time. But they classed an NCO from different companies, and you had to go around and make sure all the portholes were closed when dusk was starting to come. No lights to be shown, you know. So I was going around this time, and I walked through the kitchen to make sure all the portholes were closed in there, and I got up into the officers' quarters and knocking on the doors, and if nobody answered, we were allowed to open up and go in to make sure the portholes were closed, and I had to see they were to have a blackout. And I had been doing this for about 5 minutes or 10 minutes and that, and I came up to where the nurses were on their quarters were, and I knocked on the door and nobody answered. I knocked again, nobody answered. So the third time I was just going to knock and the door opened up, and as the door opened up, this nurse was coming out of this other, no, I opened up the door, and as I opened up the door, this nurse was coming out of the shower room, and she was starting in here, and all I could say was, "Is your porthole closed?" She says, "No, it isn't, Corporal, but I'll close it right away." And we both bust out laughing, and I guess my face must have turned beet red or something like that, because she was sure laughing after I closed the door. I could still hear her. That was the only, and I had a great big chunk of pie as I went through the kitchen, because they officers had all kinds of food to eat, all right. But then we zigzagged quite a bit, and I understand that we went fairly close to the northern part of Australia. Then back up the coast along the back up towards Hong Kong.
Was it rough then? Memory storms?
I never got seasick. I enjoyed my ride before. Of course, we'd been over on the Pacific to Jamaica, and I knew how it was to be on a boat, and I never missed a meal at all or anything else. Some of the boys were pretty badly seasick, but otherwise I wasn't, and.
The mutton was pretty terrible. Did you ever eat mutton before?
Well, I've had lamb,
yeah.
But not actually mutton. My mother used to cook lots of legs of lamb and lamb chops and stuff like that, but not to have mutton like that. Oh.
Didn't eat much mutton then, did you, George?
Not when I came back. I sure didn't.
Were you in England?
No, I went to Hong Kong. The Japanese.
That's all we ate over there, mutton.
Over in
the mutton for pork chops, mutton for beef steaks. Mutton.
Yeah, that's exactly what we had going over to Hong Kong, was nothing but mutton. That's very true.
No, that's all you have all the time.
Yet I still like a leg of lamb now, but it's very high in cholesterol, and I have to watch myself now. I'm not supposed to eat too much of that stuff.
Hong Kong, when you rent.
Is it okay still?
Sure.
Yeah.
I just left it on.
Yeah.
We're pretty informal anyway.
But, when we got to Hong Kong, we got off and marched down to our camp, Sham Shui Po camp.
We're in Hong Kong, George. I bet you'd be given anything for mutton.
Well, after we were there for a while, we sure would have. We sure would have then. That was the stuff we were missing, was the fat. But bunch of British troops were leaving at the same time. I understand that they had a regiment of Gurkhas there before we got there, and they had been moved out before we came in. And we were more or less taking their place.
Did you know where you were going by this time? I just wondered.
Oh yeah, we found out on the boat. I think after the first week or something like that, that we were going to go to Hong Kong.
Do you remember how you felt about that at the time when you were told that you were going to Hong Kong?
Well, we didn't actually feel anything. We just thought that it was going to be another Jamaica. Actually, you know, we were just going to be taking over guard duties to a certain extent. I mean, put up a token of defense of some kind, because we didn't know what the terrain was or anything else at this time. We didn't know nothing much about Hong Kong. And we were shown a few maps later on about what Hong Kong was going to be, would look like, and where we would be staying. And then also, after we got there, I think we were just there a couple of days, and then they started to take us around to show us where our positions were. And finding out in prison camp later on that it was just a big schmozzle, because a lot of the British troops that were there had certain different points where they knew the terrain. And they'd been there, for years. Mm-hmm. And then when we got there, they shifted these different British outfits, like the Middlesex. They put them over into a different part of the island, and the Hong Kong volunteers were shifted into a different place, and a couple of other British outfits, the armor were shifted from one position to another. So they weren't familiar with the different terrain that they were in. And they give the Indians along the Hong Kong all the machine gun outfits. Along the, and they should have been, as far as I was concerned, up into the hills for doing hill fighting. We hadn't had no hill fighting training. And Hong Kong Island is just a great big mountain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with roads running through it and all that sort of stuff. But we didn't know nothing about hill fighting as far as we were concerned. And the Japanese are masters of camouflage. I mean, we camouflaged our pillboxes and our stations and stuff on this principle. But as far as hill fighting was, we were concerned, we'd have been far better off down on the along the coastline of the island with machine guns.
Well, when you arrived, did you undergo any training of any kind after you arrived?
No, I can't say that we actually did. We had a couple of meals there, and then from then on, most of us tried to get out to eat because the meals were terrible. It was British rations and sawdust sausages for breakfast and stuff. You know, when you broke through the skin, it just fell out like sawdust and stuff on this principle. And I was a very big eater myself. I think I had a tapeworm. I used to have 2 plates of pork and beans in the morning down in Jamaica and a 2-pound loaf of bread for breakfast. So, and I was keeping in good shape. There was a few of our boys at George LeBlanc, and these boys, we used to do some boxing and stuff on that principle down in Jamaica. But just after that, we were shifted up to D Company. We were supposed to take over Wang Ne Shang Gap, and that's where we were stationed
This was before the war?
Mm-hmm.
Before the battle?
Before the actual battle. We were up there for about a week when the war broke out.
What kind of things were you... Did you have machine guns at this time? Or were you
no, all we had was Bren guns, and the NCOs had Tommy guns, and the rest of the boys had rifles. There was the odd Lewis gun. The odd Lewis gun and so forth in these pillboxes, and there was the odd Vickers placed in these pillboxes that were on top of the hills. And I thought myself they were out in the open far too much, like they were on top of a hill instead of being, mind you, they took quite an area they could see, but they were still on top of a hill, which could be easily seen. I mean, you could tell they were a pillbox.
Do you remember much about the pillboxes? Did you know how they had been built, or who built them, and when?
No, we just know that they were built by the British, mm-hmm. and they were cement blocks that were into the ground. You had to walk down a couple steps into the pillboxes, and they had 3 different windows, like slits, well, I guess maybe about that wide, where the machine guns stuck out of. And they were slightly camouflaged, you know what I mean? But you could still see they were pillboxes because you could see them from a distance. And we had, from Wang Ne Shang Gap, we had a road that went over, and the far end of the road of Wang Ne Shang Gap was across the valley was an ACAC outfit of the British. And we had a pillbox up on top, or I'd say about another quarter of a mile away, that the trail ran right along the cliff like this, and then he went up into the pillbox on top of the hill. And the fellows, I was there the 2 days before in the pillbox, before the actual fighting, and the ones that were there when the actual fighting came, they never did come back. The Japanese came through that way, and they never did get back. And I was at the far end of there was right at Wang Ne Shang Gap, as you came along Wang Ne Shang Gap, there was a road that ran this way, another one over towards the ACAC, and it was supposed to, there was a police station up on top of this sort of a cliff, which looked right down the road of Wang Ne Shang Gap until the first bend. And our company headquarters was, I'd say 200 yards. It would be the police station. The road came down here, and about 200 yards up the road, our company commander's billets were right here. Our ammunition dump was right in this one of the huts here. Mm-hmm. They were all of cement, steel doors, but the steel doors didn't stop the Japanese steel bullets that came right through the doors. And there was our cookhouse was right here. And then right across the way here was across the road. Well, no, this side of the road was where our cookhouse was, our ammunition, our places where we stacked all our kit bags. Mm-hmm. And then there was huts there that we slept in. They were all in. And that's where a company commander and that got killed. And across the road on this side was another 2 huts against the cliff. And this is where our brigadier and his staff, they were in there when the war broke out. And they all got killed. They tried to come out of there as far as I understand, in a group. I didn't actually see their bodies, but they were all killed trying to go up this hill. And down here farther, about another 200 or 300 yards up, was another billet for some of our boys, and our quartermaster stores was there. And at the time the war broke out, along this side of the road, there was a couple of big gaps, like hills like this. That's why they called it a gap, and which looked over the valley. And we were down at the far end. See, the road came along here, and here's where our quartermaster stores were. Here's where the two big hills were, like, you know, like cliffs cut in, the road was cut through them. And around this corner here is where I was stationed as an NCO. And the day before, I was Captain Phillips, who was with me still, who, you know, we were still in the same outfit, the same D company. He came up and told me that I was made sergeant on the, you know, on the field. One of the sergeants was killed, so he'd made me a sergeant. And I was up around with five other men, one with a Bren gun, and four other riflemen, and myself as the NCO. We were guarding this end of the gap, because we had heard the night before that the Japanese were coming through. We had been shelled a few times from Kowloon, and a couple of bombers had dropped around. They were bombing the odd time, too. And we had one of the men on guard duty. Just when daylight came, the rest of us were lying there. And all of a sudden we hear a rat-a-tat-tat, and bullets just came just above our heads. We could see the dust poke up above us. So I said, come on, fellas, we better get off of here and down onto the road and see if we can get back to the company command. And as we came down the onto the road again, we tried to get Private Gagne to come with us, but he was didn't know what was happening, and he scurried off into the other side of the road. He wouldn't come with us, and we went up. We got as far as the quartermaster stores. We met a bunch of our fellows there. More of the D company, and we tried to get back to our company commander headquarters, but we couldn't get down the road. The Japanese had taken over the police station, and they had a machine gun right down the road, and there was a couple of trucks that had been more or less demolished, and they were blocking off the road. So we couldn't get back there, so we figured that we'd try to get back to the battalion's headquarters, which was at, we were along the Shang Gap. They were down in, what's the name of that place? Oh, I can't think of the place.
If you could maybe give me which part of the island would it be on?
Well, it was more or less in the central part. It was at the more or less at the bottom of Mount Cameron, was where our headquarters were, our battalion headquarters were.
Bottom of Mount Cameron, one Chai Gap. You were at one Nishong Gap, right?
Yeah, that's where we were stationed at the time when the war broke out. I know we tried to.
That's what you were heading for anyway.
Yeah, well, we tried to go over the hill and down on the road on the other side, but they had so many snipers up there that we got pinned down pretty good. I still had my four men with Al Spears and Red Mitchell and these boys, and we got up. I guess about two-thirds of the way up the hill. Sergeant Manchester was going up the hill at that time, too, and a few others. And one of the boys I was going along with, all of a sudden he was just in front of me, and he said, wasn't one of the ones that I originally started off with, but he was just in front, and he said, gee whiz, George, I'm awful tired. And he leaned against this tree, and all of a sudden blood started to come out from behind, underneath this Bren gun pouch. You know, we had these pouches that we carried our ammunition in, and some of them had Bren gun magazines in them, and some of them, like I had, for my Tommy gun and so forth like that. And all of a sudden he just keeled over. He'd been shot by a sniper. And we got up the hill a little farther and saw a couple of other boys dead. And then we got up to this brick, this big boulder, and you could just get underneath it by getting on your hands and knees and going around it. And I was standing beside this boulder. I didn't think anybody could see me. And I said, okay, fellas, get underneath here and we'll get around the other side of this boulder. So they were getting under, and just then, I don't know, for some reason or other, my foot slipped and I went down, and just as I went down, this chunk of stone pinged off. It was a bullet that must have hit there, and a piece of it went off, and this is the last guy was going around and hit him in the backside, and he thought he was shot in the rump. And I said, no, it's only a piece of rock. Get the hell around here. They could see us. So we all got around the place, and then we got, I'd say, about 3/4 of the way up the hill. And then we just flattened right out because this sniper was picking at us pretty good. So I said, well, it's no use trying to get over the top. We better go back down to the roadway again and see if we can get out when it gets dark. They can't see us. Then we'll get around the corner and go down the road to... I still can't think of the headquarters company. Where our commanding officer was, Sutcliffe. But anyways, we got back down to the road again, and one of the boys had a bullet along his arm, so we bandaged that up, and we just sat there for a while. And then just before dusk came, we heard this rumbling, and around the corner came these two Bren gun carriers. And of course, the tops are open, as you know, with Bren gun carriers. And we started to head for the road to get to, like we were only maybe 50 yards away, well, from here to the roadway away from them. And we started to head towards them, and all of a sudden this guy from the Bren gun, he turned his machine gun on us, and we said, hold it, we're Canadians. And he jumped off. He said, what the hell is going on around here? Because he couldn't get through. You see, the road, they didn't know that the roads were blocked up to, because they were going to go up to try to get the brigade.
Were these British troops?
These were British troops that had come to rescue Huang Neishan Gap because they knew the brigade commander was there. And they couldn't get through, and this one chap, the sergeant, jumped off, and he said, they just killed the best British officer in the whole bloody world. And he says, and I hope the heck, I'm going back up there to see if he is dead. And we said, take it easy. He said, I know these snipers. And he got up there and looked into the Bren gun carrier, and he just got back out again. And this sniper took another pot shot at him, just missed him. And oh, he was really raving mad. They'd killed the best officer in the whole British Army as far as he was concerned. So we stayed there until it was a bit dark, and we met up with an officer of this British outfit, and he said, you fellows get out as best you can. We're going to try to get up to... I said, well, the road's blocked. You can't get through there. He said, well, we realize this now. But... So we had... There was an Indian there we had met. And we took this car. We had both... All the tires were flat, but the motor was running. So we backed it up and pushed it back out onto the road, and got it facing to go around the corner. And we said, let's push it around the corner first. He says, no, I think I can get it started. Well, as he got it started, he turned on the lights at the same time. And of course, it was pitch black, and all of a sudden, these lights shining. Well, right away, the machine gun from down on the at the police station opened up. And luckily, none of us got hit, because I was on this side of against the hill, and George Peterson, No, Morris Peterson went on that side of the hill, of the car, so that, because it was a big drop on this side and the cliffs on this side, and we were going to help the driver get down. So we had to put the other three or four fellows in the back seat, and away we took off, and we got around the corner, and this British soldier stopped us, and he said, "We have another wounded fellow here." And we said, "Well, put him in the, throw him in the back seat there on top of the other fellow." And his mouth was, his chin was partially shut off. So we traveled the all the way down the twisting road. It must have been a good 10 miles or so. And this Indian drove this car beautifully because he had four flat tires. And you know how it would jerk the car, and we'd say, "Look out for the cliff. Pull over to the right." And as he pulled over to the right, Morris would yell, "Look out, you're going over the cliff, pull over to the left." And, but we all got down to battalion headquarters. And Morris met his brother, which he was very happy to hear. I don't know how his brother got down there. He must have got over the hill before we ever got going. But he met his brother there. And they had a great reunion, and all of a sudden, I was left by myself for a while, and this Captain Baird came along and said, "There's a sniper up in the hill over above the..." Oh, no, pardon me. We stopped at the first aid first. We went right straight through because George Peterson stopped us at this gap. Is it? No, it's not gap. It's just above... Have you got Aberdeen Reservoir there?
Yeah.
Well, it's just above the Aberdeen Reservoir where this, where our battalion headquarters was. It's like in between Mount Cameron and Aberdeen Reservoir.
Bennett's Hill?
No. No, Bennett's Hill was just opposite, the other side of Aberdeen Reservoir.
Not Wang Chai Gap.
Wang Chai Gap. That's where battalion headquarters were. It was Gap. See, I had Gap in my mind, but I didn't think there was. That's where battalion headquarters were. And Baird said, "Well, there's a sniper over above the first aid. He's picking different fellows off." And I said, "Well, we'll go, but I'm sure you're not going to find them." I said, "These guys are tremendous in camouflage. Unless you see them move, you're not going to get them." So we went up the hill a wee bit, and then he said, "Well, it's kind of useless to be up here. We don't know what we're looking for, or where he is from, because you know these fellows could hide up in trees and everything else. They were marvelous with camouflage." So I said, "Well, where's some place I can eat?" So he took me up to the officer's quarters, and I got a meal there, and then I came out and I just flopped beside the road and went to sleep till the next morning. And then I got up, and there was a bunch of them going up to Mount Cameron, top of Mount Cameron. So I went back up there. I went up to Mount Cameron and met a bunch of our D Company boys again, George LeBlanc, the Petersons, and Bradshaw, Nixon. I don't know if you've heard about Nixon. He became a surgeon afterwards when he came back, and he got killed in Saskatchewan just after he had a wonderful practice. He got killed in an airplane accident. See, we were up there for, I guess, almost 3 days until they made, I think it was the third day, we got some food up there. They got some food up to us, and we were just starting to eat the food just at dusk when they started to shell us with mortar shells. And and that night, the Japanese came up Mount Cameron, and there was quite a battle royal then. But we were told that we had to get off Mount Cameron and to retreat back to the Aberdeen Reservoir, which we did. And mind you, I think myself it was the wrong order, because I understand that Mount Cameron wasn't taken anyways. I mean, there were still some British troops up there the next morning, and I was surprised they didn't call us back to go back up there again. But we retreated back to the Aberdeen Reservoir. And when we got there, there was nobody there. The A Company, not A Company, what company was that?
You remember about how many would move off Mount Calvary?
Oh, I imagine there must have been a few hundred that moved off of there. I know it was back the Olive D Company that was there, and there was a few stragglers of other different companies that were up there, and then it was back the Olive D Company, as I say, that we moved back to Aberdeen Reservoir. And when we got there, there was Major Bailey and his outfit were all gone out of Aberdeen Reservoir. So we dug in by the Aberdeen Reservoir. There was some foxholes in that there, and we dug in there. And this is actually where the war ended for us, because I think we were there a day and a half or something like that. And all of a sudden we were told to capitulate. And I know George LeBlanc, Bradshaw, Holden, Nixon, I think Morris Peterson, they all took off on their own. They thought maybe they could get down and get a boat or something like this. But we lost quite a few different boys up at the on Mount Cameron. Sergeant Long and a few other fellows were killed up there. So then we were all mustered together. We got different kit bags, because it was on Christmas Day that was capitulated, and we went looking for food, and we were going into these different kit bags and stuff like that, getting clothing and putting it into kit bags and that to take to camp with us. Mm-hmm. And of course everything was packed on our, we put it on our bags, on our backs, and then the Japanese came along a short while afterwards and lined us all up and checked to see if we didn't have any arms and stuff like that, and then they whistled for us to march off. I swear to this day that half that hill moved. They were all Japanese under camouflage, and when they stood up, and they had all these grass and everything all intertwined in their uniforms, and it just looked like half the hill moved. They were watching us all this time. But they marched us all the way up this big hill, just near Mount Cameron, and they gave us stuff to carry, like some of us were carrying rifles, and they handed us all the stuff to carry down for them. And I can't remember, it was an Indian barracks that we stopped at first, and we stayed there overnight, and they got some rations that night. Then the next day we were moved over to Kowloon territories. We were taken across the bay again to Shamshapo, our old Shamshapo camp.
You remember how you went across the Kobo
ferry? Yeah, we went on the ferry. They had the ferry going.
I just wonder if you can remember how you knew that the war had started. I remember, were you on Hong Kong Island at the time of Wan Yee showing back in training, or were you on the mainland?
When
it first started?
We were on the mainland, because I shouldn't. I'm not trying to bolster up D Company or anything like that, but D Company was ordered to back up the retreat of these British forces that were coming from the border of Kowloon territories in China, north, you know, like they were coming down, like say from Shanghai down towards Hong and Canton down towards Hong Kong, and these British troops were up on the border. I mean, we could hear the fighting and everything else like that. And we were told, as D Company, to go up and be rear guard. And I can still remember some British officer coming up and saying, how many men have you got here, you know, to our officer? And he says, we have one company here. He says, well, let us get through and stay here 5 minutes and then get the hell out of here. And he said, they're coming over in droves. And so we got back down into Kowloon and, you know, going through the streets to get to the ferry to get over to Hong Kong, because we were all backing up to go to Hong Kong by this time. And the Japanese, some of them had already got into Kowloon, and there was firing going on all the time, you know. And we got into these trucks and got down to the Kowloon Harbor and got onto the ferry and got over to the Hong Kong Island.
Do you remember how you knew when the war had started? Did you see a plane drop a bomb or be told? I guess it would be the day the Japanese attacked. I just wonder when you knew that you were at war with the Japanese.
Well, we knew that we were at war, but nothing happened to us for a while, you see, but they knew that the Americans and the British had declared war. I think it was December the 8th. I think December the 7th was the Pearl Harbor.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think December the 8th we were told that we were at war with the Japanese.
That's how you were told?
Yeah, we were told that we were at war.
Well, you went back to the island. I just wonder if you can remember how long you fought as a regiment, how long the orders were flowing smoothly and everything stayed together. Remember how long everything functioned?
Oh, it functioned real good as far as that goes. We got off the Kowloon territory quite nicely, you know what I mean? I mean, there didn't seem to be any mix-up in orders or anything like that. We were told to retreat back to the island, and the British went by us, and then we got on our trucks and that, and came back and headed for the ferry and got on the ferry. We didn't seem to have any trouble getting across or anything like that. It was dark. I don't know whether any shells missed us or anything like that. I didn't notice any anyways, but we were just on the ferry and we came across, and then we went right up into our position at Wang Nishangya.
Well, did you continue to function as a regiment?
Yeah, I mean, orders kept coming along fairly well, and I can still remember after the war was over, a very good friend of mine, Sergeant Payne, who was with the intelligence, our intelligence, him telling us afterwards that he had put an order over on the night of the night of the 16th, I believe it was, that the Japanese had landed on the island.
Mm-hmm.
And he was told he had pipe dreams or something on this principle that no Japanese had landed. I mean, I'm taking this right from him.
Right.
The man is not alive now. He tried to escape when I was going to go with him. And I got dysentery. Another chap that was going to go with him is Gordy Williamson, who is still here. We were both going to go with him. There was four of us that were going to go. And four still went, but they were all captured and killed. But Sergeant Payne told me at the time that he had given order that he had been told the Japanese had landed. And he'd give the order to headquarters and all that, and they said that he didn't know what he was talking about. The Japanese hadn't landed, and it was supposed to be some Indian that betrayed a lot of the boys that took them into the Japanese into different positions. I don't know whether it was under the
order of death if he didn't go, or whether or what it was, but he was supposed to have taken them into two or three different positions where troops were on defense, and he came in, and then they relaxed, and the Japanese were right behind him. But I understand that he got killed too. I mean, I'm just going, as I say, this is partially hearsay.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Did he get much food and water during the battle?
No, I can't say that we did. I had enough ammunition for myself. I don't think that we were. I know at company command now, you see, this would be, if you got a hold of Gordy Williamson, he could tell you more. In fact, I think he got a Distinguished Service Cross there. I don't like to say this, but one of the fellows was supposed to have got into the ammunition hut and locked himself in it and wouldn't open it for anybody. He just got scared. And
that's understandable.
Yeah. But I mean, he shouldn't have locked himself in the ammunition. No, he could have went into another pillbox and locked himself in. I mean, he didn't have to go in the ammunition. And he wouldn't open it for anybody. Now, whether they were getting short of ammunition there, I don't know. Because we never did get down there. And Gordy Williamson could tell you more about that if you can get in touch with Gordy.
Yeah. But you had enough ammunition.
I had enough ammunition for my Tommy gun, and not that my Tommy gun was that.
How about other equipment? Did you think you had enough, like mortars or grenades?
No. From what I understand, the ship that was supposed to be bringing our stuff over, our mortars and Lewis's and all this sort of stuff, all our ammunition was torpedoed, and it never did get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard of one instance that when the officers, I'm not positive whether it was Captain Bardell or who it was, or whether it was Captain Norris, had taken the truck down into British quartermasters to ask for some machine guns, and they told them to get the quartermaster, the officer, the quartermaster, to give them the requisition for them. I understand there was just a sergeant there, and our officer was supposed to have pulled the gun out or something on this principle and directed them to give us machine guns, or give the truck some machine guns and so forth, so they can take them back up the hill. And whether this... Hi, Frank. Whether this happened or not, I couldn't say. I'm just giving you, as I say, what we heard afterwards. But I know we were short of our own equipment. And everybody that was there, I mean, had their rifle and that, but and the odd Bren guns and that, but that's about all we had. And when we were up in Mont Carmen, they did have some. We had got the hold of a few 2-inch mortars and a few 3-inch mortars, which we were trying to bombard the Japanese. But the Japanese soldiers, they were tremendous in this field of mortar. You could never catch up with them because the 2-inch mortars they strapped to their legs, and they would go along with ammunition themselves, and just the one man could go along, and then he'd just bend down like this, throw the mortar, and the way it would go, you see. And then he would run a little farther and do the same thing all over again. And with the 3-inch mortars, we saw them, they would put them on one man's back, and it's a 3-inch mortar, has got quite a kick to it. Now. But they would strap this plate onto a Japanese back, and he would run along with these other fellows carrying the ammunition, and all of a sudden he would stop and bend over his head like this, and they would throw a mortar into it, and away it would go, and then they would run a little farther. So you could never catch up with their mortars.
But they were well-equipped,
well-prepared? Oh, yes, yes.
Good troops?
They were very good troops as far as hill fighting and that was concerned. I know they used to yell Benzai and come in. They would lose an awful lot of men, but they would take it over. I mean, they would run into a machine gun nest till they covered it with their bodies. This happened at Stanley Prison. It happened, from what I understand, with one of the officers who was wounded in both legs. I understand that he got a medal for it, that he told the rest of his men to carry on and to get out of there while he stayed with the machine gun. He said, "You can't carry me," and because he was shot in both legs, and he stayed there with the machine gun. And until it was, I know some of, one of the boys went out in burial party, he said it was jacked right up to his barrel practically before he was taken.
Okay. What did you think of your officers during the time?
Well, I would say that the biggest majority of the officers that I had any contact with were very good. There was only a couple that I wasn't fussy about. I mean, I didn't like the way they acted as officers, we'll put it that way. I mean, I was scared. Maybe they were scared too, but at the same time, they were supposed to be leaders. Just the same as an NCO was supposed to be leader. I mean, many places I was darn scared, but I stayed my... And same as the rest of the other... A lot of the other NCOs and so forth. And Sergeant Majors, as you know, Osborne and that, what he did. But there was a couple that's no use bringing, it's too long ago, no use bringing names into it. That, but if I had to, I could bring proof about it. But after the fighting was all over and everything else, we were taken to the Champchapeau camp, and when we got there, I never thought the Chinese would do it, because the Chinese could have killed all the Japanese with penknives. There were so many of them there, but all they were thinking about was looting. They looted their own stores, and when we walked into our Champchapeau camp, I'll describe it to you to a certain extent of what it was prior. We had iron beds that hinged in the middle, and when you made up your beds and that, you turned these over for inspection and so forth and that, you understand, I mean, and you had your box on the wall where you had all your stuff put in, and you also had a kit box. And even the window frames, when we came back, even the window frames, doors, beds, are what we had, are what we called biscuits that we laid on. We had three biscuits that we laid on. Everything. Big part, yeah, like cushions. They were filled with coral. Shred, like, you know. Everything. Even the window frames were gone out of the huts. All that was left was standing brick. That's all it was. The huts were right there, and all it was just mortar. Brick and mortar. The Chinese had stripped everything. And when we were in there for, I would say, how many days were we in Champchapeau? Oh, I guess maybe about 2 weeks, I would imagine. Roughly. We were in Champchapeau for about 2 weeks. And then they took, maybe not even that long, maybe 10 days. Then they took all the Canadians out of Champchapeau and took us over to the island to North Point Camp. And all the Canadians were put in North Point Camp on the island, on Hong Kong Island. And that's where we stayed until the all of 41, about the summer of 42. And then we were, that's where Johnny Payne and these other fellows escaped from, or tried to escape from, and that were caught. Then we were all moved to Champchapeau again. Yeah. across into the Kowloon territories. And all the prisoners of war were there, except for some of the officers were at, which had been transferred to Argyle camp.
You had the rank of sergeant?
No, I didn't put up my sergeant stripes. I should have, right then and there. I still stayed as a corporal. And I saw Captain Phillips, mind you, the man was injured. He had an eye knocked out of his head and that, and I thought he would put it through for me, but it never came out that way. And I never saw him in prison camp because he was at Bone Road Hospital all the time.
And were you wounded during the battle?
No, I didn't. It came close, but I never did actually get any wounds or shots or anything like that. Yeah, I was very fortunate. I got very in my feet and in my body, and I lost my eyesight to a great extent. I could only see night and day for a while. And Dr. Crawford told me to flash a deck of cards in front of my eyes as much as I could, and this brought it back to the eyesight that I've got now.
This was in
Champ Chapeau. And then I had dysentery in North Point camp. This is one reason why I couldn't go to on the escape with Johnny Payne.
Were you working in North Point?
Oh yes, we went out to work on airfield and different things on this principle. We didn't work quite as much in Champ Chapeau North Point camp as we did later on in Champ Chapeau. We were taking the Champ Chapeau, and then we were working pretty steady out at these airports, rebuilding the Kowloon airport, like making longer runways. There was a sacred hill of the Chinese that was there, which the British never touched because it was sacred to the Chinese. But the Japanese got us to not us, they had the Chinese working on it and us on the runways. And after the first plane landed, they took us off the runways because it all crumbled. We were putting something like 8 buckets of sand to 1 bucket of cement or something on this principle, and it didn't stand up very well. Whenever we could, we did this. I mean, lots of times the Japanese were there and you did it right, one cement and 3 buckets of sand and so forth. But when we could, we 2 extra buckets of sand in. And it crumbled pretty badly, so they took us off and they put the Chinese on the airport, and it got us to take down the hill, this sacred hill, so they could make another runway through that part. And then I got a bad case of dysentery, a reoccurrence of it, and I went down to 97 pounds for a while.
Was this from eating or drinking?
Well, I guess just the bad food, and we're eating out of tin cans and stuff on this principle, and I guess we just got the disease. That was all there was to it. They did bring us in some supplies, I understand that one Christmas there was 30 yen given to us from the Pope. It was supposed to have come from the Pope through the Red Cross, and we were able to buy some food from when the Japanese brought in every once in a while, and when they got mad at us, they took it out. But mind you, all you could more or less buy was a can of beans about that big, and garlic is what I ate an awful lot of. And it cost you a yen a pound, which is like a dollar a pound. We got paid on the basis of 10 cents a day for privates, 15 cents a day for NCOs, and from what I understand, the officers had 120 yen a month. They were allowed
30 some a day.
Yeah, they were allowed $120, 120 yen. Well, we classed them as dollars. I mean, $120 a month, and they paid part of that back, as I understand, into their officers' mess for extra food supplies.
I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about the function of the camp of Champ Chapeau. who would actually be in command of all the prisoners? Would it be Japanese? And would the orders filter down from the Japanese to the...
Yeah, well, I mean, we had our own standard, of course, of our own company commanders. The rules and regulations of the camp came from the Japanese, of course, and our company commanders and so forth put them down to our sergeant majors, and the sergeant majors, you know, gave them out to the rest of the company, and we had our specified duties as far as the companies were concerned. I mean, a certain amount were put on latrines for a certain length of time, and other people were put on latrines other times, and keeping the camp clean.
Did things still function in an army way?
Army bases, yeah, as much as possible. Mm-hmm. They try to keep it on the army bases as far as our own companies were concerned, although we still had to go by the orders of the Japanese, whatever orders that they had too. But actually, the orders went to our commanding officer, and then functioned through military channels, as you say. It was all run militarily on our own basis. I mean, you could still do something wrong, and you could still be put up on the peg for it, you know what I mean? Be brought up in front of your company commander. Like, I mean, you couldn't, when they called roll call, you had to be out there. Otherwise, the company commander, if you were late, the company commander could be, or the sergeant major could be getting the slapping. So, I mean, you still had to be on parade on time.
Did you begin stopping from
the Japanese?
From Japanese.
Oh, yes. And, like, sometimes you maybe, when there was a bad, when they had the diphtheria epidemic there, for matter of speaking, well, some of the fellows may be over in the quarantine building, but when the whistle blew, you had to get back onto camp. You know, get back onto parade. And if you came in late, the Japanese wanted to know why you came in late and all this sort of stuff, and it would be up to the company commander or the sergeant major to give the reason why you were late. And if the Japanese didn't like your reasoning, you got a beating. And that's all there was to it. I mean, they didn't take it out on the private that much as they did on the officer, you know, that was supposed to be in charge. So then, after that, they say my eyesight had gone there, and then I was down to 97 pounds.
This is with beriberi,
and avitaminosis and stuff on this, and dysentery, just the life that we were leading. I mean, we just weren't getting enough proper food, and that's all there was to it. I mean, and then we had this experience of what we called hot feet. It seems that the fats came off the extremities, like your feet, your fingers, and stuff on it, and then they would burn steady, 24 hours a day, every day. And the doctors told us at the time, get relief any way we could, which was put them in cold water or put them on cold cement. And just leave them sit there like this until they got numb enough for you to go to sleep. And many a time we used to put them in cold water, and the cold water would turn hot. Three or four of us sitting in cold water, they would turn warm. The water would turn warm from the heat off our feet. But then they found out afterwards that heat was the best thing for them. But to go from cold to hot, a lot of people suffered. And I did it, and my feet swelled up, and all the toes broke open, and all this, and going from hot water logging to heat, they all swelled up and skin all broke. I imagine there was quite a few of the fellows that had the same experience. And I can still remember Dr. Crawford coming in when my feet were all swollen and split open. He said, "Boy, you got a sore pair of doggies there, eh?" And I had a morphine shot that day. And I went to sleep real nice for about a couple hours. But I never put my feet back in cold water again.
Did you get much medication at all?
No, there wasn't too much at all as far as I will say. Dr. Crawford, he took an awful lot of beatings. One day he would go up there and he'd get a bit of medical supplies. The next day they'd give him a beating up and said there wasn't any. Next day he'd go back up again. They'd give him a little bit of medical supplies if they thought it would be okay. And then the next day he'd get a beating. He took an awful lot of beatings for us. And he was a big man. He was about 6'8". They had to stand up in a chair to slap him across the face. And this was their idea of punishment. They never hit you anyplace else but slapped you across the head. And then there was one outfit left to go to Japan. And we understand that the boat was torpedoed and there wasn't too many prisoners of war got off of it. There wasn't too many Canadians on it. In fact, I'm not even sure whether there was any Canadians on it, but we heard about this about 2 weeks after they left. It was torpedoed, and there was a lot of British troops on it, and as they broke out of the hold, the Japanese machine gunned them down a lot. As they were coming out of the hold, because I know when I got shifted to Japan, that's where we were just over in the hold, and the ammunition was right below us. You could see all the cases of ammunition on right below us, and all our, what were they called, tatamis, which are just flat pieces of bamboo woven together, you know, just laid on, they called these tatamis, and you just had 36 inches for each man. And
you remember when you went to Japan?
It was December of 1943. We hit Formosa on Christmas Day, 1943. And
was this a freighter that you
went on? It was on the basis of a freighter. I don't know whether it was actually one of their troop ships or anything like that. I know it carried a whole bunch of ammunition, but we were transferred to another boat because even the Japanese wouldn't go back on it. It was leaking so badly. The Japanese soldiers wouldn't go back on it. So we were transferred to another boat, and then we went up to Japan from Formosa. And I remember when we what's that city? We didn't stay there. Oshiyama, was it? Toward the southern part of the southern island. And some of the boys stayed there off the ship, and a whole bunch of us were put on trains. And it was cold. It was a blizzardy, snowy, rainy day. It was miserable. And they put us on these trains with no heat and everything else, and we traveled all that night. And part of the next day, and we went up to Nagoya. And this is where there was 5 grenadiers, and the rest were the Royal Rifles of Canada. We ended up in this camp, they just kept splitting the different people to go different places. And we hit Nagoya, and we worked in a foundry there. And we were there until '43, '44. We moved up to Toyama in '45. I think it was around April of '45 that we were moved up to Toyama, a whole bunch of us. When we were in North Point and in Nagoya, it was all Canadians there at first. Then they brought in some Americans real late in '44. And we were there together for a little while, and then they moved a bunch of us Canadians out of there to Toyama, which was another place where they had a foundry.
What kind of work were you doing in the foundry?
Packing, you know, for molds, for parts of drive wheels for train engines and stuff on this principle. Mm-hmm. But the material and that they used in these things, it was so poor that half the molds would come out, the drive wheel or the different wheels that they were making were cracked and stuff on this principle, because they were putting in kids' toys and that come out and stuff on that, and they had women there scraping through the slag and everything else of them picking out all these pieces of, you know, as you pour molded metal, it splashes out and pieces of metal are, and these women would come along and sift this sand through and pick out all these pieces of metal and they'd remelt them again. This is how far off they were, as badly off as they were for, we'll say, scrap iron and stuff on this principle. But we had to get up about 5 o'clock in the morning. We left camp about 5:45. We went on these trains, like electric trains, like there was two coaches, and we'd all be packed into these, let's say 350 of us in one coach, and the Japanese in the other coach, you know. And we'd go down to our camp, and go down to the foundry, rather, and work there all day.
Was it a big foundry?
Oh, yeah, it was quite a large place. The one in Nagoya, the one in Toyama wasn't that big. It was miniature size compared to the... But they both had the same trouble. Even their buckets that they were carrying the molded metal, the bottoms would drop out of them every once in a while. And any time you heard the overhead crane, you kept one eye up there as you were working, because if you saw that thing getting white hot, you knew that darn thing was going to drop its load. Because as it came across, it was red hot, it was okay. If it went by, all right, but if it started to get white hot, you started to run, because when it hit, it just splattered. In fact, we saw one incident of a Japanese. This was later on. I got diphtheria in my eye, which has still got the scar tissue there, and then I got my feet changed to ice cold, and I started to get gangrene in my toes. And I went up and saw Dr. Riley, and he said, well, I haven't got the tools, George, otherwise I'd cut them off. You'll have to go down to the Japanese doctor and get your big toes at least cut off. Mm-hmm. And I went down, they carried me down there. The boys that were working, they had to carry me on stretcher. When I got down there, the Japanese doctor, when I was sitting in there, and felt down in here and here, and I went like this, and he put this, he got a cloth, he said something to the Japanese nurse there, and she came and had a white gauze, and he put some red stuff on it, and then some white stuff, just like putty, just spread like putty, and he put them over my toes. And then I came back, Dr. Riley said, well, Georgia, how did it feel? I said, well, he didn't take them off, and he just about went through the roof. I said, he put some stuff on there and said that it didn't need to be cut off. So the next morning when I went up to see him, they took the bandages off. And he marveled at it, because the stuff had taken all the flesh and everything else down to the bone, and this stuff was just draining out. All this poison was just... So I had to go every morning to get my bandages changed, but I never had any trouble with the Japanese. As soon as they saw me, they ran away. They were scared stiff of this gangrene. Yeah. And as soon as I walked into the hospital hut, the Japanese medical sergeant was there. He just yelled, Brito, Brito, fix up Harrisonia, fix up Harrisonia, and away he'd go until I was out of there. He wouldn't come back until I was dressed and my feet were dressed and was away, and they had to carry me down 2 or 3 different times down to the Japanese doctor. And Dr. Riley said after, I don't know what he put on there, George, but he said he saved your toes.
Did the Japanese themselves have much medication?
No, they didn't have that much, I don't, and their food was very poor, especially in Japan. That was they had a fish. They were bringing a bunch of fish, we say, to the foundry. And the number one hancho, which was the number one man, he would get the biggest one all the way down the line. They'd all get their fish, but as they were lower, they got a smaller fish and so forth. And all the way down, like the number one hancho would get the biggest one, and the next one would get the next biggest one, and so forth, all the way down. So they issued it out like that. And then, and I know the Japanese soldiers that were, but we had sentries with rifles, but we also had what they call stick men, and all they wielded was a big long stick. And if they didn't like you doing something, they just whacked you across the back or across the head, wherever they wanted to hit you. And the experiences that we've had, I've had a few slapping ups from this one. We called him Fish Face. His face just looked like a fish. He had been wounded in China, and he'd got a bullet in his elbow, and his arm was stiff. And this is what he hit you with. He'd bring it back like this, and you know what a solid board would feel like hitting you across the face. This is what he hit you with. And he beat up a couple of boys pretty badly. When they came back to camp, they could hardly stand up. So the commanding officer of the Japanese wanted to know what happened, and Dr. Riley told him. So they called Fish Face out, and they got three fingers, because he only had three fingers in one hand. We had nicknames for them all. There was another tall one, the tallest Japanese I'd ever seen. He was about 6 foot. He had a pair of horn-rimmed glasses. He looked just like Harold Lloyd. You ever see a picture of Harold Lloyd, the comedian? This is going back a lot of years for Harold Lloyd. And we called him Harold Lloyd. And another one we called the Gorilla. We called him Dempsey the Gorilla. And he used to walk around like this, and he was always hungry. He was looking for food all the time. He didn't care whether he was a sentry or not. He was looking for food. But they called Three Fingers out, and Three Fingers beat Fish Face until he fell down, smacked him across the face. So the next day, Fish Face got a couple of fellows and beat them up pretty badly. So we reported it again, and he got another beating up. So the next day, he got four guys and beat them up. So we said, well, this is kind of ridiculous. If we get him another beating, he's going to take about six or eight guys and beat them up. So it's no use. See, this is after we got into camp, into the foundry.
Yeah.
He was in charge then. He was the chief sentry, and he would just beat them up, or he would, I don't know if you've ever tried it, by holding a bucket of water out at arm's length, and stay that way for an hour or two. Your arms fall, but you go back up again when he gives you a clip across the chops or a bang across your back or something like that. And we had Wednesday was our, what they call Yasume Day. And that was like their Sunday. Wednesday we didn't go out to work. That was when we had to clean our huts and do our clothing. And shave, if you had to shave and stuff like that. But there was one razor blade and one razor for 50 men. So you can imagine how the last guy got a shave. Thank God I didn't have to shave all the time I was there. I didn't have any whiskers. And you got haircuts. Most of us kept our hair just as short as we could, because it was easier to keep clean. So there wouldn't be any lice or anything like that.
Did you have lice?
We had lice an awful lot in North Point. There were some of the boys that kept themselves a little dirty, but as soon as we found out they had lice, them and their clothes and everything else automatically were taken into the bathroom. We had a bath once a week. They'd have like a great big, I guess the swimming pool, maybe about the size of this room. And everybody had a bath in there, and that meant there was 50, maybe about 600 men going through that. So by the time the last one was in there, it was pretty mucky. But they never changed the water. I mean, everybody had to go through, but mind you, we did it in rotation. We'll say this week, your company, A Company, would go first. They would be last next time. And B Company would go first and so forth. And then would come back to A Company, they would go first. I mean, we had to do this. To be fair, some people snuck in with other companies and stuff on that. I mean, we all tried to do it. So that you get into nice, clean, hot water. Because by the time the last guy was in there, the water wasn't as hot and it wasn't very clean either. And the funny part about the Japanese, anybody, of course we did it ourselves too, the septic sore, anybody with septic sores and so forth, we're supposed to go in last. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to go into the water last, which wasn't very sanitary, but at the same time was still helping the other people that didn't have septic sores and that. But we couldn't get any garlic in Monty, lie down. We couldn't get any garlic in Japan at all. And I still think that the garlic saved me. I never had one septic sore the whole time I was there. Because I used to eat a pound of garlic a week there for a while.
That's a lot of garlic.
And garlic is supposed to be very good for the blood. We had...
Were you able to collect any kind of a kit during the time? Like, did you have a bowl for eating?
Yeah, well, when we hit Japan, they gave us some dishes. They gave us one blanket, and it got pretty cold in Japan. We had to go down to 20 below there. And the best way we found to, at first we used to wrap ourselves up in blanket with our clothes on, and we found out the best way was to strip off all our clothes and roll ourselves up in blankets. But roll yourself up in your blanket, you stayed much warmer that way than you did with if you had your clothes on. But every once in a while, the Japanese would come in and yell kiatsuki, and everybody had to stand up at attention in front of their tatami. And when you're bollocks naked, you're pretty chilly there. And they used to laugh like mad at us. You know, we'd jump out of our blankets, and we're all just, and you couldn't hang on to them. You had to have your hands like this and your face straight ahead. You couldn't look left or right, otherwise you got a beating. And our diet was a bowl of rice in the morning, a 4-ounce small loaf of bread at lunchtime with potato top leaves or something on this principle, or if they did happen to get some leeks in or something like this, you had that for soup with your bread at lunchtime, and then a bowl of rice at nighttime.
Many vitamins,
no, the odd time we got the odd eggplant sliced up and fried in peanut oil, which we needed, and when we were in Nagoya, they came in with a big barrel of pickled locusts, and the doctor told us that we definitely had to eat these. They issued 10 per man. And he said, there's an awful lot of oil in these things, and I want you people to eat them. If you don't eat them, we're going to put them right in your rice, and you're going to have to eat them. So they issued, I think it was 2 days or something like this, of 10 per man. And some of the boys wouldn't eat them. I ate all mine. And looking for others, and if the guys didn't want to eat them, you sold it for, you bought their grasshoppers either for cigarettes or your loaf of bread or something on this principle, because everything was on a market of cigarettes right through the whole prison internment. Sometimes you could get a package of cigarettes for a bowl of rice, depending on how many cigarettes were in camp. Otherwise, you maybe get one, if the cigarettes were very scarce, you'd get one cigarette for a bowl of rice. It just depended, and everybody wanted cigarettes. Because if you had a cigarette first thing in the morning or something on that principle, you didn't feel quite as hungry. If you took a cigarette, one of the Japanese cigarettes before breakfast, you didn't feel quite as hungry. But everything was on the basis of cigarettes or trading off with, like if somebody got dysentery or diarrhea or something on this principle, he would say, okay, I'll give you my bowl of rice, you give me your loaf of bread or something on this basis. Or with bread with me over there, it was lots of times it was real hot still when it came to us, and it was like dough. And I ate one loaf, and I got a stomach out like this. I was just full of gas. So from then on, I sold my bread for rice every time I could.
Do you remember when you were transferred first time, which was in Nagoya?
Nagoya? To Toyama, yeah. It was, I think it was around April or May.
Did the foundry close down, or did the...
No. No, they brought in a bunch of Americans, and they only had one hut for the Americans. And I think they were going to bring some more Americans up. So they took a bunch of the Canadians and moved them further up north on the island to this other place. It wasn't too far distance to Toyama. And that's where we were till the end of the war.
Is it a better camp?
It was, in a sense.
They're both pretty terrible.
The Toyama one, the huts were different. We seemed to be, how would I put it? In Nagoya, we'll say that there were huts like this, straight out, and there was a middle door, and that went out to the biffies that was in between the next two, like this hut and that hut. There was what they call our biffies, and all it was just a whole bunch of holes, like little stalls, but a whole bunch of holes, a big ditch along there that you did your excreta and everything else in, and every 3 or 4 days this fellow would come in with the bullocks, a great big bullock, a beautiful looking animal, all shiny and everything else, and he would pick up all the excreta in ladles and put it into these great big wooden boxes he had on his wagon and take it out and put it on the land, you see. This was the Japanese. He had the contract to pick this stuff up, and he was very happy to do it because he put it onto his land. Yeah, very true. And then there was 25, there'd be 100 on that, 200 in each hut. And it would go along, you'd have 25 men on top, 25 men below. And the distance between, you had to duck your head, like I'd say maybe
four and a half.
The beam, yeah, the beam would maybe be up to about that, the end of that mirror, to maybe about that high off the ground. So you'd be in between that space and there, and then he'd be in between that, the next one would be in between that space and the roof. And you had 50 men along each side. And there was 200 men altogether, like 50. There was 100 on that side of the side door, and another 100 on this side of the side door.
Any window or any heat?
All we had was little cutout places like this of brick that every once in a while they would give us charcoal to heat. There was two on each end of these sort of. Would be about dug out about that much into the ground, mm-hmm. and they'd give you some charcoal in the cold weather. And what we did then, sometimes, like some of the fellows would maybe eat just half the rice in the morning and leave the rest until they came home, so they could have a bigger supper. And then they would reheat it up over the like in their pans. Some of them had mess tins, some of them just had ordinary tin cans that we heat the rice up, although we still had, in Japan they did give us china bowls that we could eat out of. Because this is the way your rice was measured off, was one of these bowls.
Did you use your hand
or spoons? No, we had spoons. I mean, practically everybody had a spoon or a fork. Some had whole sets of artillery, of cutlery. Just depends on whoever got picked it up, or maybe there's a bit of a food. He'll be right. Came along and he said, "What would you rather?" And of course, we all had food. He said that he was supposed to be educated in Oxford, England. He could talk perfect English.
This is in Nagoya.
And he told us at one time that he was a virgin and all the girls chased him. I mean, he was kind of a queer duck, and yet he was supposed to be educated in Oxford. And then a couple of times he felt kind of happy, I guess, because he put on some music through the speaker. He said, "Now I want all you boys to start dancing." And we all looked at each other as if, well, what kind of a nut is it?
Yeah.
But he came around to make sure that we started to dance. But he was very cool in another way. There was one of the American boys, while we were there, disappeared. They didn't find him for 2 days.
Did he escape?
No, they found him up on top of the cookhouse, up in the rafters. And he had come down at nighttime and eat as much as he possibly could find to eat. And then back up there again, they missed him for 2 days. So when they did catch him, they put him in, they stood him up. This is one of the things that they always did, was stand you out in front of their sentry box in front of the camp. And every time anybody went by, they smacked you across the face. So he was stood out there all day long. And what was it that they gave him? A week, I think it was, with a bowl of rice a day. And after that was over, he was back up in his camp for a while, up in the hut, behaving himself and so forth, and all of a sudden he disappeared again. And they looked all the way through the cookhouse and everything else like that, and they couldn't find him for a couple of days. But that's where he was. And when they caught him again, they gave him 30 days in the brig and only a spoonful of rice a day. And he didn't last the 30 days.
What was the brig? Was it like an enclosure room?
Yeah, it was just by the sentry. I've never got into it, thank God. But it was behind the sentry box that they had there. They had a room for prisoners. I don't even know if it had bars on it. I never actually got around to see if it had any bars on it. You weren't supposed to be over that way, so I didn't go over that way. The only Japanese that I learned was my own number, because you always had to call out your number. We used to be able to count up to 100 and that. Because mine was Yakunana, which is 107. I'll never forget as long as I live. But some of the boys learned to talk Japanese to a certain extent, and because they learned how to talk to some of these soldiers that were trading in Shamshapo camp and North Point camp. Like, they would come in to try to get your, if you had leather boots, mm-hmm. or leather belts, cameras, watches. And they would always like to try to bring you money. And practically everybody wanted cigarettes, of course. Mm-hmm. And that would be quite a bundle of cigarettes. Like, they would say, "Okay, we'll give you 200 yen for your watch." It was fine and dandy if you could buy cigarettes in camp. Like, the odd time they did bring in some cigarettes, but it was very few and very seldom. Mm-hmm. And the ration officer, actually through the Red Cross, you're supposed to get a package a week or something on this principle, and we weren't getting our package a week of Javi. I guess he was copying them all, I guess, you know. But every once in a while, they would bring in cigarettes for us to buy. And if somebody had a whole bunch of money, we'll find them down to do it. If they just made a trade with so many cigarettes and so much money, say for their watch or something on this principle, but then they could go ahead and buy a bunch of cigarettes. And this is the way, as they say, the food commodity was based on the amount of cigarettes that were in camp. And if there was a lot of cigarettes in camp, you got a lot for your food. Like, when we were in North Point camp, we had three bowls of rice, had one in the morning, one at noon with a slice of bread, and one at night. And the slice of bread lots of time would be worth one cigarette, or it could be worth five cigarettes. And stuff on this principle.
The second camp you went to in Japan, I forget the name yet.
Toyama?
Toyama. What kind of work were you doing there? Is foundry work?
The same thing. Exactly the same sort of thing, yeah.
The same kind of foundry? Was it bigger and smaller?
Well, it was smaller. It was quite a bit smaller. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't too far away from our camp. It was only... I would say we walked it every... It was. I don't suppose it was any more than a half a mile.
Was it only Canadians there?
Yeah. That's all that was there was Canadians. And there was one British officer, Dr. Ryan. He was our medical officer. And August the 1st, I can still remember it on my mother's birthday, the Americans came over and bombed it.
And
they sent down a whole bunch of incendiary bombs, and they burned a lot of Toyama, and they scorched all our huts, especially one end of the huts were all scorched. And we were all moved out into rice paddy fields, you know, out by the rice paddy fields, and we all told to sit down and face the camp. And this is when we really got quite scared again. We figured, we always thought in our minds that the Japanese would kill us before they would leave us. And we were all facing our camp with our backs towards the Japanese behind us. We could hear the clicking of the rifles and bang, bang. They were shooting off their guns. And we figured that they were killing the fellows behind us all the way along, you know. But nobody got shot. Mm-hmm. But this is an experience that we had.
Mm-hmm. Well, I meant to ask you, before the battle was over, before the surrender, did you have any idea what the Japanese would do to you or whether or not they would take prisoners?
Well, we thought of it. We didn't know whether they would or not. Mm-hmm. We weren't sure whether they would take prisoners at all, because they sure... didn't do anything for the Chinese. They sure killed them off by the hundreds. Because I remember in Sham Shui Po camp, when we were there for a few days before we were moved, we were there for, say, maybe a week or 10 days. The bay, the Hong Kong Bay, was right outside our camp. We could look out and see the bay and that, and the river that was coming along to run into the bay. And it was just covered with bodies, Chinese bodies. And most of them were all bloated. They'd been in the water for quite a long time. And their hands were tied, hands and feet were tied behind their back, and I guess just dropped into the drink that way. But they sure killed lots of the Chinese.
Did you ever get any outside information to find out what was happening in the war, whether the Japanese were winning or the Americans were winning?
There was, we heard different news, mind you. I myself personally never saw the radio, but I understand that there was one in camp, and where we got an awful lot of the news from.
No, this is in Japan.
This was in both places, mm-hmm. Hong Kong and Japan, that the we had Hong Kong volunteers in Hong Kong. And they had, I know they had radios in Hong Kong, mm-hmm. And part of it came from when we went out in working camps. They'd pick up a Chinese paper, well, I imagine it was in Japanese, and we had interpreters. And this, mind you, lots of times it was distorted. In the papers, but we knew, I think it was 2 days after the war was over in Europe, we knew the war was over in Europe. We were told the war was over in Europe.
The Japanese tell you? Or
no, just through the Japanese papers. By this time we were in Japan, but going out on work parties. Some of the boys were pretty good in pickpocketing. And they would swipe a Japanese paper out of some of these guys' pockets even. And I know I actually saw the papers in camp. And the interpreter would give us the news, and then, of course, the paper was burnt, as you could understand. So that nobody would, they would never find a Japanese paper in camp. I mean, he would go through it right away and interpret it and then burn it. Which also helped us an awful lot, you know, morale, we'll put it that way.
What kind of things did you do for morale? Was there anything planned, or was it mostly just spontaneous?
Well,
newspapers?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was spontaneous to a great extent. The Japanese never cared too much about the sick people, and some of their, thinking back on these things now, one time wouldn't talk too much about it, but now thinking back on them, I mean, it's a long time ago. If they were sick, rations were cut. Anybody that was sick only had half rations. But the commanding officer of our camp, anyways, and I imagine it went for all camps. I don't know, but I would imagine it would. Everything was divided amongst everybody. I mean, whether you were working or whether you weren't working, because the next day I could be out working, you could be sick, or something on this principle. You'd be half rations and I'd be full rations, and I'd have to give you part of mine. But everything was put into, and everybody got exactly the same out of the buckets. But like, say, for instance, when there was a real bad sickness on, we'll say maybe 100 men sick in camp, that cut an awful lot off the rations. And these guys were out working all day long, come back in, and instead of getting a full bowl of rice, it'd be maybe down to three quarters of a bowl of rice, which wasn't very, because they would give you your rations for the day. The Japanese would say, well, okay, here's so many bags of rice, you've got so many sick and all that, that's it. And they were very cruel that way. And another thing they used to pull off was they'd go up to Dr. Riley, who was our doctor at the time, was an English Air Force doctor, and they would say, okay, we want all the men you can possibly get, because anybody that goes out to work today will get a Red Cross parcel when they come home tonight. And so he would get everybody, and this was pulled off on him three or four times, but he could never take the chance of saying, okay, you stay in camp because you're not able. He said, anybody that can possibly walk, get out there and go to work. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese, well, a lot of us, even if we couldn't very well, we'd still get out there and try to work and that. And when they came back in camp again, there was no Red Cross parcel, and the doctor was told, okay, we want the same amount of men out tomorrow. They're not very sick. And then he would have to send them out for two or three days, and some of the boys would drop. Yeah. I know I went out to work for almost 2 months. And every morning when I got up, I could hardly straighten, but I would straighten, and I'd go up and see the doctor, and I'd say, I'm sorry, George's other fellow's worse off than you. Because he kept testing me at the back, like, you know how you tap there. For your lungs. No, this, I found out afterwards, this one morning I got up and I couldn't straighten. So a couple of fellows carried me up to Dr. Riley, and he just bent me over. I was bent over. He just tapped, okay, George, in the hospital. My lung had all filled up with pleurisy. But it was starting all the time, you see, but other fellows had pneumonia, and they were worse off and everything else, and he'd say, well, okay, George, you have to go. So I would go, and then this one morning, they say, I got up and I couldn't do anything, and as soon as he hit, okay, you come go downstairs and get your wood kit you've got and bring it up here, you're going into the hospital. And well, I guess I was up there about 10 days, and the Japanese doctor came in and he checked me, and he went out and came back in with a hose, a rubber hose with a chrome nipple on it, And Dr. Riley said, well, I guess I got to drain you, George. And he says, you're not going to get better this way. So I put my hand up like this, and he felt in between my ribs a certain part, and then punctured it. And this tube wouldn't let the fluid run out. So he took the, unscrewed the tube, and he put a syringe in there, and drew out 1,300 cc's of fluid out of my lung. And he says, when you get back, George, he said, you better keep checking that every 6 months in case of TB. He says, that's the next thing, that's the closest next thing to you can get to TB. But I did have a bit of a scar tissue, and I mentioned this to the, because the first time I took an x-ray, they said, you got a spot, and then I explained to him exactly what I'd had. And I hadn't had any trouble since with it. But I never could get any insurance.
This Japanese doctor that did train the crew, was he a good doctor? Is he the same doctor that put things on
you? No, that was the factory doctor. This was a Japanese doctor that came around, went around to all the camps.
Mm-hmm.
And he would just come in and see what this is and what that is. And maybe he'd leave some supplies, maybe he wouldn't. And I can still remember I had diphtheria in the eye. That's why I was up in the hut. But these other fellows were supposed to be consumptious. They were coughing like mad. And they had these seven or eight fellows at this end of the hut. And I was down all by myself down there. Mind you, I was still in the same hut. But I was down farther. I was supposed to be by myself because of this And I laughed like the devil. This one day they see the medical officer, the Japanese medical officer coming. Okay, fellas, when he walks in here, you know what to do, eh? I didn't know they'd done this before. I'd only been up here a couple of days when the Japanese doctor came. As soon as he stepped in that door, boy, the Japanese doctor just walked right out again. Because he came in with his mask on and everything else. He just took two steps in there, and these guys started to cough and hack and everything else, and away he went. He never did stay to check him or anything else. And it was while I was up there, I was quite fortunate because Dr. Riley said this is the last diphtheria shot or the second last diphtheria shot that we've got. And I said, how do you get diphtheria in the eye? I mean, I didn't believe him. He says, George, any place where there's moisture, diphtherial germ will stay alive. And he says, and if we didn't have this shot for you, he said, more than likely, very shortly, you'd get it in the throat. Because the germ would be around. And he said, if they gave me this diphtheria shot, then they quarantined me there. But it was about 2 days after that, I was back down in camp again, and then they brought these Americans, and all these guys that they had quarantined for consumption and all that were all back in their companies anyways, because the Americans had to take over that hut. They had brought 200 Americans in, so they took over the hut. So what was the difference? But it was just the Japanese way of doing things. Okay, this guy's getting TB and I put him in quarantine. But as soon as they needed more room, put him back with the rest of them to heck with them, you know.
when the Americans bombed the, I guess it's the city?
Yeah, the town of Toyama, because it wasn't that big, you see. And then we went back into, that was August the 1st, we went back into our camp and for some reason or other, we seem to start getting a little bit more ration, and we seem to be, they seem to turn out the lights a wee bit later. You know, in my mind, none of us much had, as far as watches, there was the odd one maybe that had a watch still, you know, because most of them had been traded away. And then I can still remember August the 15th, we went out to work, and we were there, I guess, till about 10:30, I think it was, or 10 o'clock. And all of a sudden, speedo, 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 back to campo, campo. And we all lined up, and we had to run practically back to camp. And our camp was all fenced in, but there was a great big yard. And one side of it, one length of it, was supposed to be for an air raid shelter. All it was a hole more or less dug in the ground, which had been built over with mud and and stuff on this principle, just in case of shrapnel, I guess, because, I mean, it wouldn't have stopped anything as far as if a bomb would have landed there, it wouldn't have done very much good. And we went back, and we weren't allowed to go into any of the huts. We were all supposed to stay out in the yard. And all the Japanese went inside, and the sentries and everybody, and we could look down the hallway, because it was just one long hall that went straight through to the camp commandant's office, and he had his bedroom upstairs, and he had to go up a flight of stairs to it. And on the other side was where the sentries stayed. They had their hut there. But ours were off of that. Like, it seemed to be more compact in Toyama.
Right.
Mind you, there wasn't quite as many of us there. I think it was about maybe a little over, maybe 250 to 300, that was all that was there. Whereas in the other camp, we had quite a few more. And we could see them all standing there, and then all of a sudden they all bowing and standing up like this. And every once in a while they'd give a shout out of something. And here it was, we found out afterwards, because from then on, we could keep the lights on as long as we wanted to. They started bringing more rations. In fact, they even brought in a live pig. And that was the most comical thing to see. They put the live pig in where our showers were, which was something that we never had before, was showers. And because they didn't have no place for us to have a bath, so they had showers there. And they put this live pig in there. And you should have seen three of our cooks trying to catch it, to kill it. It was the most comical thing. We were looking through the door. It was the most comical thing you ever saw, them trying to catch this pig to kill it. But we had pig that night. But we never did have any more or less dealings with the Japanese. They stayed on guard duty. And I think it was August the 15th. I think it was around the end of August. Now it was the 31st, the 1st of September, something like that. That we knew the war was over then, but we got it officially through the Swedish Red Cross. This fellow came in; he was a white man. I mean, you know, it wasn't Japanese Red Cross. Yeah, he just arrived at the camp and told us that the war was all over, and we had 2 minutes silence, and the Japanese interpreter that we had in our camp there stood there beside this fellow and took off his hat too. Mind you, he had been in the United States for years and years, and he had just gone over to bury one of his relatives when the war broke out, and he had to stay. But when we had the 2 minute silence for the, you know, and then we sang "God Save the Queen," and he sang too, which was, and then we never saw him again.
Just disappeared.
He just disappeared. I don't know whether he went with the Swedish consulate or what, or whether the Japanese took him away or what the score was.
Did they bring any food?
Yeah, they brought more food in. We had more rice and stuff on that principle. And on September the 28th, it was a wonderful thing, and yet it was a sad thing because we lost another comrade that day because of foolishness. In fact, the pilot was killed too, which is very bad about it. But they came over and dropped a whole bunch of foodstuffs, like canned fruits and all this sort of stuff, in big barrels. And this one plane came down quite low. He was going to put stuff right into the camp, because this was, a lot of stuff was falling outside of the camp, of course, and we were going after, but so were the Japanese civilians, because there's a lot of good stuff in there. And he came down pretty low to drop into the camp, and he didn't realize his flagpole was there. and he just realized he was going to hit it with his wingtip, so he turned his plane, and he was so low to the ground, the other plane tip hit the ground. And the plane went over and killed the pilot, and he was only 19 years of age. And there was a couple of other personnel in the plane that were throwing the stuff out. One was, I think they were both officers or something like that, and one had a broken arm. And the other fellow just had a bad shaking up. But the pilot, he was just twisted right around his cockpit. In fact, we had to saw his leg off to get him out. Dr. Riley got in there and he started to saw and cut. And he got the bone, the flesh away from the bone so he could start sawing the bone. And it was kind of cramped quarters. And I know I sawed for a little while on the man's leg. And then another fellow went in and finished cutting through the bone. And then the doctor went back in again and cut the rest of the flesh. But he examined our hands first because if there was any cuts or anything like that, you couldn't go in there because it seems that if you got that dead blood into a cut or something like that, you could get some type of poisoning or something on this principle. So that was a bad thing. And there was one of the Navy fellows that was in camp with us, and he got to the plane first. And without anybody knowing, he grabbed this bottle off the side of the plane and stuck it in his tunic. And all of a sudden he was drinking this stuff and he started to get sick and sort of greenish color. And here it was a defrosting fluid, or de-icing fluid. And here he thought it was a bottle of whiskey or something on that principle. So we lost him too, which dampened it, although everybody was quite cheerful when they started to drop it all, but it kind of dampened the whole thing to a certain extent.
Were you able to load into the town at all?
Yes, we did, but as Dr. Ryan, I wouldn't want it too far. He said, you never know how these people feel about you. And I know we had quite a few of the civilians around. They were jabbering away in that. We had to get the interpreter out, and they had another fellow there come as interpreter and trying to explain to them that it wasn't, that they were all hollering because some of these things went right into their huts, into their houses when they were dropping them, like some of the parachutes wouldn't open, and these big drums would just come came into the roofs, and they were claiming for damages and all this sort of stuff, like, you see. So as Dr. Riley said, you can go out if you want, but I wouldn't wander too far away from camp because you never know what these people feel like, you know. I mean, they're just as liable to maybe shoot you. The funny part about the whole thing was the day after, I think it was, or 2 days after, the Swedish Red Cross fellow was there. All of a sudden we woke up and there wasn't anybody there, no sentries or nothing. All the Japanese had disappeared, all the soldiers, the camp commandant included. They'd all just left. We were all by ourselves then. And of course we didn't know how to get in touch with anybody or anything. But it was in October. Was it about October the 4th? 3rd or 4th, that because we had to put a guard up on top of this plane all the time, and they
a guard on
the plane so the Japanese wouldn't get there, you know, or try to do anything with the plane or anything like that. You know, it doesn't make no difference if a military plane goes down, there's always a guard slapped up on it, or any kind of a plane goes down, there's always a guard slapped on it right away. Before any civilians and that, if possibly, if they can get a guard on there fast enough. Even ordinary planes, if they crash, to find out how it crashed and that. So we had a guard on there, and I think it was about the 3rd or 4th of October that the Americans came and moved us out of there. They put us on trains, on trucks, too. Then they got to the trains, and we went right to Tokyo Bay.
By train,
then we got off at Tokyo Bay, and we were...
How did you ride on the train? First class?
Oh, well, they just took us. I mean, we were just happy to go. We didn't care how crowded it was or anything else. We just went just to get... get there. I mean, minus their the Japanese trains, they're like, they go pretty fast. They're electrical, and they whip along pretty good clip. So we went to Tokyo Bay, and then from there we were taken over onto the Awatewa, was the ship that. No, pardon me. We were taken over to this sort of a hospital ship, and we were sprayed, you know, all our clothes taken off, and we were all sprayed, and the clothes that we had were burnt. They let us keep some of the stuff that we had there, you know, in that we were able to salvage for ourselves. Blankets and all that sort of stuff, of course, were all disposed of. And they had interrogators there to let us know what the Japanese, whether we were injured or scarred or anything like that, or whether, you know, what sort of sickness that we had. I mean, it was very quickly done. And then the ones that were real bad were put onto the hospital ship, and the other ones, we were taken over to the Awatewa, which was an amphibian tank carrier. And we were on there, and I think we stayed there that day and that night. And I think the next morning we moved out and we went to Guam, and we were there for a couple of 3 days, and then we got to Seattle from there. Well, we stopped at Pearl Harbor for a day.
Guam, Pearl Harbor,
and then Seattle. Yeah, thanks, Frank. You like a biscuit or something like that? And that's when my family first heard about me.
Well, were there other
ones? I got a... There was a reporter came on the... on this boat as we came into Seattle there. They were allowing these reporters to come on, and I happened to be just there with this fellow, and he took a picture of me and everything else, and asked me where I was from, and so forth. And that's how my mother and that found out that I was still alive.
The picture was published in the
paper? Mm-hmm. I think so, because this is how they found, or from what I understood, because it was over another week or so before we got back to Winnipeg. Because we were from Seattle, we went to Victoria Island, mm-hmm. and that's mm-hmm. where we got new uniforms and everything else. And we were allowed to go out if our uniforms, all our badges and everything else were on, and the women there were marvelous. They stayed there all day long, and I don't know what time, nighttime, sewing on badges and all this sort of stuff, because we couldn't leave unless we had all our stuff on. And then from there we went to Vancouver, because we were in Victoria Island for a couple of days. But when we hit Guam, this is quite a comical thing. We hit Guam and we were walking along. Of course, we were all in American clothing, their fatigue clothing of the Navy, blue denims and blue shirt and the white sailor's hats, you know. And this fellow came along with his big suitcase, and he said, "You fellows from the American Army?" "No, the Canadian." "Okay." He walked down. We watched him. And here he stopped these other two guys, and they must have said they were. And we walked over a little close, and here this fellow opens up this suitcase, and it's full of $10 bills. And he gave both these Americans $100, closed it up, carried on to see if he could find any more Americans. And when they hit Pearl Harbor, there was another guy there handing him another $50. And no, we got $5 to the American Red Cross from our Canadian Red Cross.
Did you eat much on the way back?
Well, I mean, I'm glutton of myself. I came out of prison camp with 115 pounds. And when I hit, and that was, I'd been eating for a couple of days, and I'd been eating there for a little while too, because we had a lot of canned fruit and stuff on that principle. You know, like when they dropped all this in chocolate and all that. I still only came out of the prison camp about 115 to 120. And when I hit Seattle, I was 195.
But I was just... weeks later?
That was only a matter of... within 3 weeks, I was 195. But I was blowing up like this. When I walked, my feet squished. I had so much beriberi that I could write my name all the way down my leg here, and it would stay there for hours. It was just like, my legs were just like putty with this wet beriberi. I just blew up. And when we came back here, they started to give us this vitamin B shots, and this took a lot of the moisture out of our system. See, our pores were all closed. They wouldn't... Myself, I think it was the wrong thing that they did to us. They let us eat as much as we wanted to, and I think this was the wrong thing to do to us after starving for so long. That I think this is why an awful lot of people have got stomach trouble and chest trouble and everything else, because I think it was just too much rich stuff all of a sudden.
Did you have any cravings for certain kinds of food?
I did when I first, I sat, and I think I must have ate for 24 hours of canned fruit. I just opened up can after can and just sat and ate canned fruit, canned peaches, canned pears, anything that was fruit. And yet, I mean, I still like it, but I never ate any sweet stuff for a long time afterwards. But I think myself that they did the wrong thing. I think even if they would have got us out of prison camp and taken us to Guam and put us on special diets in Guam, I think we would have been far better off. You know, because I watched one fellow put a quarter of a pound of butter on a slice of bread and eat it. Well, the next few minutes he was in the biffy. I mean, it was just too rich for him. I mean, I know I put extra butter, but I mean, I didn't put quite as much as that on. But I mean, this is, well, when you're craving something, you're going to eat it if it's in front of you, aren't you? And I don't think it's, I didn't think it was the right thing to do. And another thing I didn't think was the right thing to do either was, I think myself that they should have got, we were almost to Seattle before we passed the Canadian hospital ship that was heading for Hong Kong. Now I think myself they should have got all the prisoners of war and got them onto some island or something on this prison, unless the ones that were desperately sick. Like there was one chap, he lives over here now, Harold Atkinson. He was the first Canadian back here on American soil. They brought him right back by plane. He was so bad. But, pardon me. I think myself that what they should have done was got all the prisoners of war. Even if they took them all back into Hong Kong, all the Canadians and the Americans into another place, and checked to see who was alive and who was dead. Because there were so many people at every one of these trains. I know when we came in, there was people there that were looking for their husbands and sons and so forth and that. And I knew of a couple that had died. But they were waiting for them to come home.
Mm-hmm. They were never notified?
They weren't notified. As I say, I think they should... Well, the armies didn't know, because the Americans were bringing us out of Japan, and the Canadians were going over to the Hong Kong and bringing them out of Hong Kong. So they didn't know who was alive and who was dead in Japan and everything else that had left Hong Kong. Because there was a lot of people that died in prison camps. We lost more people in prison camps than we did doing the fighting.
Can I ask what kind of changes you saw in people between the time you went and when you got back?
Well, I can't actually say that. I just know that I was very happy to get back, and I can't actually say that my family had changed at all or anything on that principle.
Maybe your attitudes must have changed.
My attitude to the, and even to this day, and yet it's the funniest thing, of all the craziest things that we did when we were in Victoria Island, bunch of us went out and we got stoned to our gills. I mean, we couldn't drink, but we bought all kinds of liquor.
Mm-hmm.
And where did we end up? At a Chinese dance gardens. Mind you, there was a big fight. They had to call the police. But, and I order Chinese food and stuff like that to this day, but yet I wouldn't trust any one of them. I wouldn't trust the Chinese or the Japanese. Again. I mean, it may be a little cynical on my part, but... it's not that so much. It was that the way you found them so two-faced. I mean, and you were seeing the Japanese people and the Chinese people. I mean, when the Japanese were coming into Kowloon and all that sort of stuff, I mean, why should they go ahead and rob everything? They were robbing it off their own people, too. Maybe they thought the Japanese were going to take it, but they were robbing their own. The Chinese were robbing their brethren's stores and everything else. And I think if they wanted to fight, if they would have fought for their country, I don't think the Japanese would have ever got in there in the first place. And I think if it happened again, I think the Chinese would fight, because there was thousands of them killed for nothing. I mean, after the war was over, they were torturing and shooting these Chinese and stuff on this principle by the hundreds.
What was your attitude towards the Canadian government? They helped you much since you got back?
Well, I didn't have any trouble right from the very...
First of all, you've been being disabled because of what happened in Hong Kong. You were in prison.
I just say, with my own experience myself, I still remember Dr. Crawford saying this is going to take 15 or 20 years. He says, and you stay in the Army until you are discharged. Don't you try to discharge yourself, like some of the boys did. They just came back and said, I want my discharge, and got out as fast as they could. And I stayed until the medical doctors looked me over and everything else. I told them everything that had happened to me, and I told them where my file was. It was supposed to be Dr. Ryan, Captain Dr. Ryan of the British Air Force, that he was supposed to send all our files back, exactly what happened to us in camp. I said, as far as the other stuff in Hong Kong and so forth, I imagine Dr. Crawford has got a lot of files of that. And I explained exactly what I had, all the diseases that I had and everything else, and what I went down to in weight and my eyesight. And I was treated all right. I mean, I went through the whole works. I was discharged in 46, March the 22nd of 46, and by September of 46, I was classed as 100% pensioner. In the first 3 years, I was given reboards, I think six times in the first 3 years, but since then I've only been called up once. I went to the pension board myself one time for an attendance allowance. I got a raise there because with my eyesight and that, for instance, I can't do the painting and so forth and that, so I have to get somebody else to do it for me, which is costing me extra. And these sort of things, you know. But as I say, as far as I'm concerned, the Canadian government was... I was treated well enough. I know the Hong Kong Veterans Association fought, as you know, it came through not too long ago for them to... everybody to get a 50% pension, if not more.
It's just that it took a long time to get that.
Yes, and...
some people weren't able to get it.
Well, as I understand now, that a lot of these fellows that did pass away and so forth, that their widows now are able to get it, but what sort of a hard time did they have? Because some of the husbands and passed away, you know, long before this came through, and they may have started quite a few hardships all that time, bringing up the families and that.
Well,
did
you talk
to her,
I guess, for a while?
Oh, I guess so.
Hi, hello.
Hi, May.
Do you think there's anything else you'd like to add or talk about?
No, there's not.
I mean, it was 4 years of your life.
No, this is true. It, But I think I've touched on more or less all the basic things that that happened. There was one incident to understand any Japanese, for a matter of speaking, could yell Kiyotsky, and everybody had to stand to attention. And then, as soon as the Japanese walked into your hut or anything like that, the first man who saw him yelled Kiyotsky, and everybody stopped what they were doing and stood at attention. And then he'd say Kere, and you'd all bow. And then he'd say Nore, and you'd all stand up and look straight in front, because you didn't know whether it was a sentry or whether it was an officer or what. So you just stood there. And one incident that happened was obviously one of the fellows yelled Kiyotsky, and everybody stood to attention, and it was an officer with his stooges coming along, like, you know, three or four little fellows behind him, and he walking along like this and checking on this person to see if he was blinking or anything else on that. And he went down one side of the hut and back up to the middle of the hut again. And he was just going to walk out the side door to the next hut, and this fellow came in whistling. I don't know whether what he was whistling, Yankee Doodle or something, but he was whistling. He just stopped dead in his tracks when he came up in front of the officer, the Japanese officer. He just stood at attention like this, and the officer brought up his sword with the scabbard on it, clunked him right over the head and knocked him out, walked over him, and all the rest of them walked over him too. A couple of seconds later, he jumped up and yelled Kiyotsky, and they all figured he was coming back again, the officer. So they all stood to attention, and he said Kare, and they all bowed, and he said Nore, and they all straightened up again, looked straight ahead. And he says, and I want that every time I come into this hut. He said, I just got knighted by the camp commandant himself. A big goose egg on top of his head. But I mean, things like that. But we had our own discipline and stuff on that principle, because we had to have our own night guard. And at different times, there was the odd food stolen from one prisoner, by one prisoner off another prisoner. And if they were caught, they were put on night duty for the whole night. That meant that he had to go out to work all the next day, and he still had to be awake all night long. So he didn't get, I mean, this was our own personal punishment of the camp. But if you were caught stealing off of anybody else, if you got caught again, you'd be on there for three nights.
Were there ever any escape attempts in Japanese prison camps?
No, not.
People just leaving the camp, well, in the cities, the villages?
No, not that I know of, not around our camp. There was nobody trying to escape in Japan. There was attempts, as I say, in North Point camp. And I understand there was some...
rather futile in Japan. Everybody would almost recognize you right away as being Japanese.
Well, this is true, too. And then not only that, I mean, you didn't know whether there was any sympathizers out there anyways.
Yeah.
For you. Anywhere along the line. I mean, how could you get clothing or anything on that principle? You'd have to kill, I would imagine. And where could you go in Japan? I mean, it's all Japanese. How would you be able to hide out, or where would you head for? So that's one reason why I don't think there was there wasn't any attempts in ours. As I say, this one fellow, as I say, he didn't leave camp, he just hid away in the cookouts. But in North Point camp and also in Shamshapo camp, I understand that there was attempts by the British, and I know there was four of our Canadians that tried an attempt to escape, but
that wasn't successful.
But that's the only escaping that I know. And as I say, Gordy Williamson and myself were supposed to go with Johnny Payne, and I got dysentery, and so did Gordy, and neither one, but they did pick up another couple of fellows, and we heard of them, that they were captured and tortured to death. This is all what we heard. The Japanese told us that they'd captured them, and we never did see them again or anything else like that, so I imagine they were killed.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's anything else. I mean, that
we touched on Africa. Oh, I know. I want for your name. I just have your initials. And I'm wondering what your first two names are. What's your full name? How you would have been enlisted in the Grenadiers?
Well, I was listed as George R. Harrison.
George R.
It's, which is George Roy.
On the association mailing list, it just says everyone's initials.
Yeah. Well, my full name is George Roy Harrison. But I think if I'm not mistaken, I think I just put myself down as George R. Because that's how my pension checks, and I imagine that's the way my name must have been put down on the paper, was George R.
Training before the battle. The battle. Surrender and imprisonment. Oh, one thing I... What did you think of the Japanese guards in the prison camps? Some of them have mixed feelings, but...
Well, as far as North Point Camp and the Sham Shapole Camp, we didn't have too much to do. In North Point Camp, we were a wee bit closer because their barracks was right beside us. And they used to love the idea of smoking a cigarette halfway through and then throwing it down into the prisoner's yard. And some of the boys would go and pick them up and smoke them. Which I think is, I don't think it was the right thing to do. Not that I'm that proud. I'd smoke cigarettes off of some of the other fellows. I mean, we'd light up a cigarette and all of us would, five of us would smoke off it, but we didn't think it was very right to go pick up a butt that some Japanese threw down to us. And, but otherwise, they didn't seem to bother us. There was only one fellow that we ever had any trouble with, as far as I'm concerned, was the Kamloops kid. He was a Japanese that was educated, born in Vancouver in Canada here, and educated and went to Kamloops, B.C. for his education, the college there, university there. And as soon as he came into our camp at Sham Shapole, he was in class as our interpreter. He just asked where the Canadians were, and he lined up about 15 of them and smacked them all until they fell down. Just beat them up, and he was the only one that would search. He said, "I'm the only one that's going to search the Canadians' camp." And he said, "If I find anything, boy, you're dead." And he said, "You fellows used to call me Four Eyes over in Canada." And that was one thing I did like about Mackenzie King. That when they had the Burma trials, Captain or Major Crawford now, or in fact he's even higher than that, he hung the, on his own testimony, I think he hung the camp commandant and this Kamloops BC, Kamloops kit. And Kamloops said, "Well, I'm a Canadian citizen, I want to be tried by Canada." And that was one thing about Mackenzie King, as I understand, said to bring him over to Canada, "Well, hang him as a how would he put it? Hang him as a traitor to the country if he classed himself as a Canadian citizen." But this is the only, as far as the ones in Nagoya, all of them seem to be all right except this one fish face that I had anything to do with. Three Fingers used to get mad a couple of times and he beat up on a few fellas. But he seemed to be sorry afterwards to a certain extent. I don't know whether it was my own imagination or what. But the other fellow seemed to be Dempsey. He used to just go around looking for food. He didn't care whether he was a century or not. But Fishface was always looking for trouble. And if he could give trouble to any of the prisoners, he gave it to them. He was the meanest one of the works, as far as we're concerned.
How were they treated by the commandants?
Who?
The Japanese guards.
Well, as long as they would, like, if a sentry, a private sentry, met up with, we'll say, Fishface, who was a corporal or a sergeant or something on that principle, or Three Fingers, they would bow to them. The sentry would have to bow, and of course, any time the officer came along, they were always bowing to him. How they were treated otherwise, I mean, as I say, the only thing that I can tell you about is when we complained,
he was beaten up. Right.
But what they did otherwise in their own army, I know this is one thing that they did do, is that if they did do anything wrong, this is the way they got was slapped across the face and that, I mean. But we didn't see that sort of stuff. If they were being disciplined on account of their own mistakes in the army. It was only what we saw as complaining about a sentry or something like that.
Well, I think that's... We've touched on everything that I was going to ask about.
Well, I hope I give it to you as proper as I can. I mean, I just...
Is there anything that wants you to think of?
No, I can't. I can't give you a lot of my personal experiences and so forth that's happened to me, and that you can't actually put into words how you felt and stuff on that principle. And maybe I imagine if you'd have talked about this 10 years after the war, you wouldn't have got nothing out of it. Because I don't think, in fact, imagine you can find some of the fellows even now that would say,
yeah, well, there are quite a few
that won't even tell you anything.
That's right. Yeah.
And I figure, well, it's not that I want to be on tape or anything on that principle, but I figure if you're trying to do a job, if I can possibly help them, I wanted to help. You know what I mean? This is how the way I looked at it, anyways. As I say, maybe if you'd have caught us 5 or 10 years after the war, maybe you wouldn't have gotten nothing out of me either. But you sit down and think about these things after a while, and I mean, I'm glad that you... I'd had 2 or 3 letters, and I was at this way and that way, whether I should sit down and talk to you or anything on that principle. And then we got a letter from the Hong Kong Association, if you wouldn't mind cooperating. Mind you, I'd made up my mind by this time that I was going to say, okay, come on, have an interview, whatever I can help you with, fine and dandy. So I hope maybe some of it will come out in with the rest of the boys. Because as I say, as far as the Grenadiers are concerned, Ross, is that there's one fellow here still in the city that could tell you practically everything as far as I'm concerned with in that I was with. It was Watson in Japan, because there was Watson right from Saskatoon, and Watt, I don't even know whether Watt's still alive. I know Watson is still alive because I've seen him, but there was only 5 of us Grenadiers together in Japan.